we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And we are talking tonight about the classic 1960s series set in the classic 1980s, UFO, episode known as Subsmash. And a brief
Subsmash! Killstreaker!
Oh, wait, no.
I don't know. I just too much Hulk Smash going through my mind right now.
Hulk will Subsmash.
Subsmash! Yeah.
Let's start with a summary of the episode.
Oh, let's.
A UFO is sinking ships at sea, the perfect way to abduct humans without anyone noticing. Except that Shadow notices and sends their top skydiver team, led by Commander Straker and Paul Foster, in search of the underwater UFO. They find the UFO and are damaged in the encounter before the UFO is destroyed. Skydiver is trapped on the ocean floor. The air is running out. Escape efforts are hindered, and Straker has claustrophobia. Who knew? Will Colonel Freeman and the Subsmash team arrive in time to save Straker and the others?
Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun. Yeah. It's really the putting of the story is kind of short and sweet. So what'd you think of this episode?
Well, actually, I'm gonna say that in response to what you just said. It's a question. Is there a pudding to this story?
There's Straker's maniacal claustrophobic laughing.
Yeah.
Isn't that worth it just for just for that scene?
It was. Well, hey, we got to actually see emotion.
Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable with this whole Straker claustrophobia thing.
Yeah, that was quite a revelation, wasn't it?
Yeah, especially...
I mean, and the way it was kind of given to us, and, I mean, Alec volunteers to take the mission, and all Straker says is, skydiver, you know, it's kind of spacious for a sub or something along those lines. And
yeah.
And I thought, oh, the guy's got claustrophobia. How nice for an Air Force pilot.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Air Force guy. Not to mention that, come on, the moon shuttles?
Exactly.
The moon base? It's only when you're underwater that he's claustrophobic, apparently.
Well, I think it's got something to... It's just the confined space. I mean, not moon. Moon base certainly doesn't feel that way. And we've really not seen too much of the interior of the shuttles, so it's kind of hard to say with those. But the idea of being claustrophobic while underwater, it's not an uncommon theme, so I'm not entirely surprised that they went ahead and visited this.
So have we seen Straker in Skydiver before?
No, it was the first time.
Hmm. I wonder if we'll ever see him again in Skydiver, and if so, will he still have claustrophobia?
I'm going to hazard a guess. And the guess will be yes, no. In that order.
In that order. Okay, that seems fair enough. So let's talk about this plot. Actually, an interesting idea that if they put a UFO in the water, it won't deteriorate.
Yeah, I remember hearing that in, I don't know if it was in this episode or not, but years ago when I was a kid and saw UFO sporadically on television, I do remember hearing that. And I thought maybe this was going to be the episode, but no, it wasn't. And what we got really wasn't a UFO anyway. It was more of a probe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I assume that there was somebody in it, but... I don't know. Still, it's, you know, it's got their murky motives behind it. I think, you know, sinking ships didn't make much sense. And it wasn't until Colonel Foster and Straker are talking about the fact that they could use that to abduct bodies and people wouldn't notice. Which is, in a way, is not a bad idea.
Well, true. But, I don't know, when you were exploding a ship like that, your body parts that you're going to be salvaging are going to be a bit mangled. I mean, it, to me, it seemed like a rather odd way of harvesting for body parts.
Well, maybe all the people who jump off the ship and get into the water, then they take them.
Given the nature of that explosion, I don't think they had much time.
Well,
it was a pretty big boom.
You know, they don't need the whole bodies. They just need bits.
I know, but even those bits are going to be messed up.
Although, how do they get those bits back?
Bits back?
Yeah, back to the planet.
Ah. Well, the probe throws out a big net.
Well, and you know, if it's going to stay around under the water for a while, does it have like a fridge to keep the body parts in, or?
Just one of those many questions that we have about the UFO aliens, you know, many things that we still do not know.
It seems like in the flying ones, they come in, they land, they shoot up a couple people, take them back, and then try to leave.
Yeah.
But this gave the impression that they were there for a long-term kind of haul. Like an extended underwater mission. I don't know. Sink several ships, collect...
The whole methodology seemed kind of unusual.
Alien. Almost
yeah,
alien.
Well, yeah, alien, but at the same time, somewhat illogical given the amount of time that has passed since the UFO aliens have started coming to Earth and have been attacking and harvesting people. It just felt like a very strange tactical change.
Another strange tactical change is that they have Skydiver basically dead to rights. And instead of finishing it off,
they just move right on.
They try to escape and fly.
Yeah.
And, of course, that gives Skydiver the opportunity to launch Sky One and blow it up, even though they're sinking at that moment, leaving them without one way of escaping the sub. So we've got the top-picked crew, according to Straker, and that consists of, I think it's Lieutenant Chin.
Yeah.
And the other guy whose name I can't remember. Ellis or something like that?
No,
that's not
no.
Ellis. That would be...
No. No, you're thinking of Lieutenant Ellis.
Yeah, I'm always thinking of Lieutenant Ellis. Yes.
Yeah, I know you are.
And then they've got...
I think his name's like Lively or something like that. Lewis.
Lewis. Oh, yeah. How could we forget that name? And then Nina from Moonbase, who apparently is really good from on subs, too.
Yeah. I was really surprised to see her there.
I
didn't
too.
Recognize her at first. I mean, it's like, oh, wow, without the purple hair?
Yeah. You know, one thing I don't like about these newer episodes, though, is they've or whoever directed this episode, is they've given up on that whole... I'm going to make you think the women are wearing the see-through tops like they used to.
Oh,
yeah. You know,
yes.
Yes,
it was very obvious
that
there was underclothing. Not like the first time we got a glimpse and we were all like, whoa.
That's daring clothing. Wow. It's like, no, not so much.
Not quite so, Sylvia.
Good point. So she's on the base, I guess, or on the Skydiver just to give Sky... Straker or somebody to chat
ogle
with.
Over.
Yeah. 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 And Foster. I mean, not dangerous at all to send out two of your top commanding officers and onto a sub to search.
I can sort of see why Foster is there, but I'm still really baffled at why Straker would be there. I mean, it's really a bit reckless on his part.
Trying to get over his claustrophobia, apparently.
This is not a good time for therapy. I'm sorry.
Anyway, so we learned a couple things about Skydiver. One is that it has a sea skimming mode.
Yeah, it's kind of far out.
Not quite a hydrofoil, but apparently jet engines, and it can kind of lift itself up in the water and scooch along.
At pretty good speeds.
Yeah, we couldn't tell how fast, but it looked like it was...
Yeah, it was
doing
cooking compared to what we've seen it do in the past.
We also learn all about its escape hatches because they're broken. Well, two out of three of them are broken. But
yeah,
I kind of like the idea of the... So as they get trapped, sunk to the bottom of the sea or to a sea shelf usually. They can get out of the sub by using the escape hatch, which even though it looks big enough for to cram two people into.
Thank you.
They can only handle one. They can only put one person in, even in a desperate emergency situation.
Oh, heck, it could take three, let's be honest.
Well, you got to get the camera in there.
Oh, darn.
Yes, it looks
There's always something. That pesky cameraman.
To me, to fit at least two and maybe three people.
Yeah, well, you could put a scuba tank on,
you've got. But, you know, you could carry your scuba tank or something. But, yes, in desperate circumstances, which apparently they were.
That's pretty desperate.
It is pretty desperate.
I mean, okay, we do find out later that the, let me see, what did Checker call it? Sorry, it was a flood launch tube.
Yeah.
Even though, no, granted, we find out later that it's not quite working. But even assuming that it is, Straker had to do was put Lewis and Foster in there.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe Chin.
Mm-hmm.
Although, given Chin's condition after the attack, he, you know, maybe it was a good thing he didn't. I don't know.
I got the feeling the reason that they put Nina in there is that she was the only one skinny enough to get out.
That's what I thought, too.
But if it weren't that, that tube was long enough they could have fit three people in there before they blew the hatch.
Yeah, but it, like, you know, it she was... Of everybody there, the one person with the smallest frame,
yeah,
body frame, and even she was getting kind of stuck in there a bit. So it made only sense for her to be the one to go in there, and also, this is a cute little writing gimmick. It sets up this whole damsel in distress situation almost.
Yeah, because just for our listeners' sake, when they try to blow her out the hatch doesn't blow, but nobody knows. They didn't blow.
No, so she's no trapped gauge. Isn't that unusual?
Not even a pie plate.
There's nothing
with a dial on it. Yeah,
I mean, I would have thought, just as there is a panel that tells everybody or anybody watching that the outer hatch isn't working, there should be some kind of panel that lets you know whether the flood launch tube is functioning or not. I mean, it's safe to assume that you would normally put like a torpedo or some kind of weapon in there, and if it is a torpedo, you definitely want your flood launch tube to be able to function.
Now, they said it wasn't a torpedo tube because those were trapped. It's something to do with Skydiver, but I don't know what. It didn't make any sense.
No, not to me. But I, at the same time, I would have imagined. And if it does have to do with just Sky One, then I would imagine there still needs to be some kind of panel that monitors the condition of that tube. So it sets up this. I don't want to call it an idiot plot, but it sort of takes away a little bit of the plausibility of the story at this point, just for the sake of creating dramatic tension for Nina. It which made that a bit ingenuous.
I suppose. I didn't mind that subplot too much, but... This was, you know, very UFO-like episode, and it's really kind of a procedural.
Very much so.
You know, here we are. What would we do? How thoroughly prepared are we? How are we going to escape? And I think there was a lot of references back to the fact that they all had training in this and they all did stuff that shows Shadow is a
lot
very
of good it did for some of them.
So Shadow has a lot of preparation and structure, which is all, of course, down to Straker. The part that bothered me, apart from the fact that the escape hatch could fit easily two or more people, was the pumps, because they had the nuclear reactor offline, the pumps weren't working very well. And it would take 90 minutes to recycle the escape tube so that they could open the door and put another person in there. Now, that's fine. I understand why an airlock is there and why it works. But really, considering the size of the escape hatch, considering the size of the sub, would it have really hurt to open the door early and let an escape hatch or two's worth of water pour into the sub?
No.
That was my first thought when I watched it, after they put the first guy. And I said, well, this is stupid. Why don't they just open that door?
Well, the other thing that kind of gets me, we understand why they take the nuclear reactor offline, is because the coolant isn't quite working.
Mm-hmm.
They never really gave any kind of estimate as to how long could the reactor function. We don't know. And I think that was it's a worthwhile question, because assuming the reactor is on, that would pretty much say that the pumps would then get rid of the water inside the airlock at a very, very quick rate. Gee, you know, you could get your people out really fast.
Yeah, that's a possibility too. I think there may have been something about damage to the pump as well, but I'm not sure. It's hard to tell because of the confusion.
Think there was something. You know, but there's a lot of ambiguity in this.
Things are wrong, Commander. Things are wrong. That's all. Anyway, I first thought that. I thought, you know, after they put the first guy out and they said, now we have to wait 90 minutes. And I'm thinking, oh, they just opened the door. And then I go, wait, you know something? They're smarter than that. It's probably because the door opens inwards to the escape hatch.
And it would be able to handle, you need to get the water out because the pressure of the water would keep that door closed.
Exactly. And I said, hey, they're not so stupid after all. I thought that was just an incredibly bad plot point.
Yeah, guess what?
Until they put the next person in and the door slides open, it doesn't push in or out.
I mean, now maybe there's something unwritten that says the door can't open if there's X amount of water inside the airlock.
Maybe.
But, you know, a little bit of an exposition on that would have been nice.
So let's talk about Chinny Chin Chin.
Ooh.
He's the, sonar – not sonar.
No.
That's Nina. He's
more like
communication
navigator.
He's kind of Sulu and Chekhov in one guy.
Yeah.
I think. And when the UFO shoots the sub, this arc of power flies through his headphones, or the noise, or
we hear a very high pitched squeal almost.
And his consoles blow up and he's flung aside and he's damaged and he's hurt. And through most of the episode, he's an injured man who occasionally hears that high-pitched noise again. But then towards the end, he goes berserk.
Goes nuts.
Destroying the panels, trying to damage all the equipment.
Almost trying to get out while the water is still inside the airlock.
Is that what you got out of it?
That's sort of what that's one of the things that I got. But at the same time, I mean, it was hard to really tell. He was just on a rampage at that point, and he was just banging everything and twisting everything that he possibly could.
The fact that he was
all the dials and knobs and buttons and God knows what else.
The fact that he was hearing the sound that the UFO had pushed into him, were they
mind
controlling him?
That's a good question, and I wondered about that. It was one of my points in my notes. It's very unclear. Because at first you think, okay, maybe this sound that we're first hearing during the initial attack, maybe this is just a byproduct of the attack itself. But later on, after Lewis has gone out, you start to see, you know, the camera trains in on Chin's face, and we, the viewer, we hear the sound. And we're to assume that that sound is what Chin is hearing inside his own head. And it was a little bit puzzling. What was that supposed to be? I'm not sure. It seemed like some unusual form of mind control. I mean, but if that's the case, it never really went anywhere in terms of a plot point.
I watched it with that in mind this time. Previously, when I watched it, it's like, is he going nuts? Is he going to control? And this time I watched it to see if there was anything that I could take out of it that would tell me one way or the other. And the only thing that I could take from it is that he does seem to be deliberately trying to smash the controls. It doesn't seem to be like I'm straining to get to the door and opening it. It is, I've gone to the console. I'm trying to destroy the console. I'm trying to bang the controls on the escape hatch and you know, the pump controls and things like that. He does seem to be directed towards destruction as opposed to just like wildly lashing out at people and acting ordinarily mad, I suppose. But that's the best I could get. Was it did seem like he was deliberately striking equipment, not like not at Foster, not at Straker.
Oh no, that was clearly the intent, clearly was intent to do damage to the sub itself. But the motivation behind it is what's very puzzling. I found it very unusual. I mean, the story was very uneven in that area.
Yeah. The things I did like about this story, though, was despite the things like the escape hatch being big enough for more than one person or possibly opening the door or any number of things like that, they did present Shadow in that positive light of having prepared, as I kind of mentioned it. I mean, they have the sub-buoy mechanism that deploys out, and they've got the sub-smash teams that are ready to go. They've all practiced the escape. It's not just that they have learned about the escape hatch or about even going out the evacuation tube. They've done it. They've practiced and done it. And when the thing goes south, they have duties to perform and steps to take to prepare for the sub-smash procedure. And I like that. I like that about Shadow. I like that. That's a bit of world-building that they do in this show.
It's one of the best things this television show does. And we get throughout the entire course of the series, we get a lot of that kind of world-building. This is just another little facet of it, and this, I think, that was probably the strongest element in this episode.
There is one thing in this episode, though, that I adored with unreservedly to the director, to the set designer, like, you guys, you know, stand up and applaud. They were on tilted sets.
Yes, it was they were on a gimbal.
That was
I was very impressed.
You know, they're having to struggle to stand on straight ground. You know, Foster's having to prop himself up on stuff when he's doing his lines, or they're lying back against walls or climbing around things. There isn't a flat surface for them to stand on that entire set the entire time that it's down at the bottom. And that really adds authenticity to those shots.
It gives it a lot of realism to all those scenes that are taking place in there. And at first I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe these guys are just really bloody good actors. And I mean, that was my assumption, that the set was very, very static and that the camera had done, you know, the tilt, the whole big thing. But when after Lewis has gone out the hatch and they're pumping out the water, they don't pump all of it out because Foster opens the door and water comes pouring in. And that's when I realized, ah, this is on a gimbal. They have rotated the set. Bravo.
I also liked bits of the dialogue, like when the sub-smash team is flying out there and Freeman is on board rushing to save his friend. And he's talking to the professional sub-rescue divers. And he is desperately trying to get them to give him
some kind of information. So, you know, give me a guesstimate.
Something. And they are...
They're unable.
They're unable to. And they tell him that. And it's like, can't tell you. No way.
We don't know anything.
We don't know anything.
I mean, it could be really, you know, easy peasy. It could be a nightmare. We can't tell you until we get there and survey the situation.
And, you know, that's basically your top commander there pushing you for an answer, and they're giving him the right answer. But, again, it's a very sensible answer, and it's a sensible piece of writing in that respect.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
Some of the detail in this story was spot on. Other parts of it, I thought, well, okay, I'm not quite so sure about that, but okay, let's move on.
So Paul Foster goes out through the sub-smash team is up top. They've rescued Lewis. Foster goes out. Chin is dead. Nobody knows that Nina hasn't gotten out yet. Although the Subsmash team did tell Straker before the phone went dead that that they hadn't found Nina yet. And he begins to go
a little nutty.
A little bit mental. There all alone, without the air. The claustrophobia climbing in on him now.
I don't know if I would call it hallucinate, but maybe.
Yeah, we had all that stock footage of his son being born and being killed and his ex-wife telling him how much she hates him and
never wants to see him again.
And he does that about the time he hears Nina calling for help and banging. And I thought it was kind of cool that he actually thought he was hallucinating
right.
it. Which was like, no, it's we all know it's real. You've got to go rescue her. But no. So
it shows a certain, vulnerability. I don't like that word in this particular case. But it shows another, an imperfection, a plausible imperfection in Straker.
Having had that little episode, he goes and opens the door. Did he go to open the door to see if the voice was really there? Or he convinced himself the voice was really there? Or did he go to open the door to end the suffering?
I think he went to open the door to see if the voice was really there. Not to end any suffering. Or maybe he thought that... actually, this is what I got. And I cannot explain why, but this is what I got. That somehow he thought that Mary was behind that door.
So it was the madness. Because, you see, for our listeners' benefit, the evacuation tube that Nina's in had explosive outer door. So she crawls in there, and they seal her in, and then they blow that hatch, and out she goes. But it's not an airlock. There's no way to pump the water, to seal it back up and pump the water out. So it's a one-way only, one-person thing. So once they've sealed her in there, and once they think they've blown the door, opening that door is certain death for everyone on the sub, because it's unrestrained, open to the outside world. So yeah, when Straker opens that door, there was a very real chance that the ocean would flood in, and that would be the end.
Yeah, but I at the same time, when he was a little more lucid, he did get report that Nina had not made it out.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least they had not rescued her.
Right.
So I think, again, this is what I got out of it. And that is, in this state of delirium, he's hearing the banging. He's hearing in his mind the voice of Mary, who had been the love of his life. And in this fevered state and just total nutty delusion that he's under, he goes to the door to answer it. I don't think it was to see if the voice was real or I don't know, maybe. But I kept getting the feeling that somehow, because Mary kept showing up, Mary and his son John kept showing up in his mind, and he's hearing the banging. I kind of got the feeling that he thought that his wife would be behind there.
Hmm.
And well, because certainly he was very surprised when he saw Nina. At least that's the impression that I got. That like, oh, I didn't expect to see you there.
Yeah. See. Yeah. That's. Yeah. That. But I don't get from his performance leading up to that. I just can't take anything from it that says, this is the madness, this is Mary calling me and I'm delirious, or anything. I don't get it. He goes to that door, he opens the door. I cannot tell from his expression or his acting in any way, shape, or form.
Would you consider this to be a flaw in the writing? Or in the directing / acting, however wherever you want to lay the blame?
I would.
I would too.
I would either, it's either the acting or the directing
or the writing, or all above.
Well, since there's no actual dialogue, I'm not going to blame the writer.
Well, but the writer he writes the direction. And, you know, he's writing out the story saying Straker is going to go here. And this is, you know, because this is what Straker is hearing. So the basic concepts of the story are coming from the writer. And I kind of think that wherever, you know, that somehow the writer has to have some kind of culpability for what we saw on the screen.
But there are times, and in fact, I was one of the other episodes we did recently with Simon. We were talking about an episode where in the prisoner where I have the script books, and so I'm looking through these, and sometimes they talk about the changes that the directors made from what the writer put down, and it totally changes the meaning of the scene, or it just totally ruins what the writer had. What clearly the writer had intended on the page, and then the director, for whatever reason, felt they wanted to tone the performance down, or they wanted to leave something a little ambiguous, I don't know. It is the triumvirate of the writer, the director, or the actor there. Or a combination of the above that just says it's just not really clear whether, you know, if he had just said one line of dialogue, like,
something Mary, to clarify the situation.
You know, Mary, as he's opening the door or something like that, then you would instantly know that he's opening the door for Mary.
We're not given that. I don't know if it was deliberate that we were not supposed to get that. It just made that scene rather enigmatic.
And, you know, so if he had said Mary, then you'd know he was kind of delusional. If he'd said the name of his son, then I'd say he was killing himself. Yeah. He could have done anything there, and made that
clear up the scene.
Clear up very quickly, but it isn't. So we'll never know if Straker had cracked so much that he was trying to kill himself. But he finds Nina.
It would be nice to know what exactly, you know, like with The Prisoner, what did the writer have in mind? Did the director change it? What? I kind of like to know.
So he comes. He's got Nina on board now, and they're both using up the air to wait for Freeman and the Sub Smash Boys to come up with some clever way to get them out, which, by the way, is not working well because the pumps are now shot. The ship's 5 hours away to bring the equipment to lift it off the bottom. The air's running out. I mean, things are bad for Straker and Nina.
It's really dire.
It's the end. It's the end. And Nina says one of the worst lines in the history of television: "I'm glad it's you here with me."
And then she tries to not take it back, but clarify it.
Clarify
some way,
how badly that
made
sounded.
It worse.
I know. Well, I don't mean that. I'm glad you're the guy who's going to have to die with me. I mean,
if I have to die, I'm glad you're with me. It's like, what? You're saying the same thing. You're not making this any better. Stop talking, woman.
You are definitely not making any sense. Then, you know, we go into the final death wait, and Straker is writing out the captain's log. At first, I thought he was speaking it. And it's being done in voiceover.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, commendations to the captain, the sky crew, the skydiver, and this, that, and the other, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, really? You're out of air, and you're going to be...
You're going to talk?
You're tape recording this? And it turns out that's just voiceover.
It's all in his head.
He's writing it down on a piece of paper. Now, what about that last line that he writes on the things? To tell the tell Dr. Psych Man, whatever it is, tell him signs of claustrophobia.
None.
Why did he say that?
You know, which kind of makes me wonder, why did you really have to bring the claustrophobia up in the first place?
Yeah, I don't...
Because it really does not play apart. I mean, the only time we actually see anything is earlier on in the story, where Straker is just a little bit, you know, a little hesitant in certain scenes. You know, you see him kind of looking around, but that could have been written in a completely different way and still be able to deliver the lines.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to bring up this issue of claustrophobia just for no reason, because that's exactly what happened.
Yes, basically, claustrophobia had very little to do with this episode, unless, again,
Was there something that was
going into Nina?
Yeah, I don't know.
Opening that up was a direct result of the claustrophobia, and otherwise, you know, we were supposed to know that more obviously, that that was not him breaking through the claustrophobia, that was him succumbing to the claustrophobia, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
Who knows?
Yeah, that was kind of, but so why is he telling the psychiatrist this? Is it, he obviously has suffered from claustrophobia. Holding his head and laughing maniacally at one point, or actually
twice.
At 2 points, twice. Yeah. Once before this, once again afterwards.
Stock footage.
And he writes that in the book. It's obviously a lie. He obviously thinks he's going to die. So this is the last thing he's telling to his psychiatrist. And he's lying to him.
Well, maybe he thinks he isn't.
That's a third possibility. One is that he's, well, the two possibilities are that he thinks he isn't, and he's wrong. No, it is three possibilities. The second is that he has overcome his claustrophobia, and he's telling us that he's broken free of it, that it's not bothering him anymore, and that that was his cure. And the third is that he was just out and out lying to him. And if he's lying to him, which I think it almost has to be, what benefit does it do a dead man? Or is it just to preserve the legend that is Straker?
I think that's all it was. Just to preserve the legend. But at the same time, I don't believe that Straker was deliberately lying. I believe there was some kind of denial. I mean, the claustrophobia, well, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I really don't know how claustrophobia manifests itself and how people respond to it. And given the fact that at the same time there was a lack of air in the sub, I mean, who's to say how much was oxygen deprivation versus claustrophobia? Not quite sure. I mean, I would imagine the two of them were playing, you know, messing with Straker's head at the same time. But did he have a full-blown claustrophobic attack? Well, no, not really.
Straker's log, his final words, and then he starts to laugh maniacally. And then I starts quoting the Anglican Book of Common Prayers, 1662, with regards to committing bodies to the deep and all that stuff. And then there's a huge explosion along with more maniacal laughter. And then they're in the hospital and everything's fine. Didn't like that.
No, I hated it.
Did not like that at all. That was very...
I felt cheated.
Yeah, and then the solution was, oh, yeah, we just went down there and we just put some explosives and boom, knocked you right off that shelf. I was like, really? That was... Nah. Nah. And, of course, everyone's having a laugh. Straker's having a cigar in the hospital, in Nina's room. And everyone leaves except for Straker and Nina, and they have a little awkward, that's the only word for it.
It was
incredibly
very
awkward moment where they talk about what they did,
what they said, and what they
didn't say. And it's, I feel like Nina's kind of like embarrassed, and Straker's like, hey, you know, I'm lonely, right? That's kind of the feeling I got out of that.
Yeah. It was... Oh.
It's like, you know, you and me, babe.
God, yet another story point that just left me shaking my head when it was over.
So we don't know if... Which is kind of funny because it was Nina that they got pictures of Straker with that they gave to Mary all those years ago that broke up his marriage.
Yes, because Nina was the one who showed up at that pre-shadow meeting.
Right. So she's a very early operative and also the cause of Straker's marriage falling. So I can see why he might think he stands a chance there. He is the boss.
Yeah.
And they didn't have sexual harassment laws back when the show was written anyway.
And Nina, I've always found her to be exotically beautiful. I think she's quite lovely.
She's smart. She usually has that hideously awful hair. But
I'll give her that. I'd say the hair. Yeah, granted, whenever we see her on Moonbase, she normally has that purple wig. And to be honest, in this particular case, the wig works better. Now, I do know that there is an episode later on down the road where her hair is down. It's her natural hair. And that was the first time I remember seeing her without the purple wig. And I thought she was a knockout.
She's quite an attractive woman.
I think she's stunning. I know you have a thing for Ellis.
You know, without the purple wig.
Yeah.
There was one thing I wanted to talk about. Well, you're just getting older, Paul.
Oh, yeah.
The older you get, the more precious life becomes. You become aware of what life really is. That's awfully deep and philosophical at that moment.
At the same time, it did not entirely feel inappropriate.
No, again, it's not what I expect from a 1960s action-adventure melodrama.
Yeah, well, I have a funny feeling that the network execs would agree with you, which is why they wanted more aliens and more shoot 'em up.
Why we have Space 1999 today and not UFO Series 2.
Exactly.
It shows two things. I mean, maybe it shows three things. It shows a number of things. I shall just count them off until I run out of things that it shows, and then we shall count them afterwards. One, that Straker is aware of death. I mean, that is showing the seasoning of him to understand death. And, of course, we know that Straker has seen his share of it, including his son.
He's been surrounded by death.
He is not the happiest of individuals in this world, and he's aware of it, and he's aware of life. It's him passing that knowledge on to Paul Foster, who is frankly still young enough to be the action guy.
You could almost say that he was that he is the Straker before.
Yes.
Shadow.
There is a certain amount of that, except of course we know Straker was always the calculating genius, at least. And I don't know that Foster is that. Foster is obviously very competent at what he does, but I don't think he's got brain.
No, he's nowhere near as pragmatic as Straker can be.
Of course, Straker was a lot more human in his,
Younger days.
Early days. Yeah. So. And then finally, there is a fatherly feel to it, that there is actually probably affection might be the strong word there.
No, but I would agree.
But I think...
Yes, I completely agree. It would make sense. Now, I'm going back to the episode where Foster was... It was Kill Straker, that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation towards the end where Straker takes Foster into,
the killing room.
Yeah, a killing room. And he did so with the knowledge that, or with the faith, the belief that Foster would overcome whatever brainwashing he was undergoing. And afterwards, Straker showed a great deal of compassion towards Foster.
Yeah, he showed
and there was genuine affection in that compassion. So if this story here, Subsmash, is further on down the road, I mean, granted, we don't have that much character development or that much story arc in this particular series, but it's nice to think that if Subsmash does take place later on down the road after Kill Straker does, this would be a natural next step in the evolution of their friendship and working relationship.
Yeah, they have been... When the show starts out, Straker is portrayed as strict, heartless, calculating.
He's a heartless bastard.
And he's still capable of being it. But there's a difference between being a heartless bastard because you are heartless and being a heartless bastard because
the job demands it
to be.
Yeah.
And when we start the show, you can't tell which it is. And no, in fact, just, it's probably played off as if he's just a heartless bastard.
Yeah,
because a lot of people make that comment about his calculating brain and all that stuff. And it's like, that's because he has no money. They're doing like he's Spock. And as we've moved through this, we have progressively seen little bits where he's goes through the death of his child, where he goes through his marriage and divorce, the episode where he gets conned by the woman and he puts the heavy gosh, I'm a lonely old rich guy thing on her. He's clearly emotionally has some needs that way. We see it in this episode with Nina. We see it in the episode where he doesn't kill Paul Foster. And, you know, and we see it here with this episode. So I think they have been slowly unfolding the puzzle or the riddle or the whatever you want to call about Straker throughout the show. And I do appreciate that about the show. He's not as one-dimensional as we thought when it started.
The final thing that really bugged me to no end was the resolution. Because as we both observed, as bad as things were going, the story dictated that things were actually getting worse at every turn. That no matter what they could do, we can't do it. I mean, first, okay, you know, we can't pump the water out. It's going to take 90 minutes. And oh my God, the door's jammed. And oh dear, we're running out of air. And oh my God, now we can't pump the water out at all. And then, I mean, we really get it spelled out to us when after Foster has been rescued. I mean, you see Lewis and Foster, they're both on the rescue plane. And they're being told, you know, there's nothing we can do. And Foster's like, or not Foster, but Freeman's like, get me a gear. I'm going in there. And so what are you going to do? I don't know. I think it's something.
Freeman to the rescue.
And then next thing we know, we do hear right at the last minute after this so-called heartfelt conversation between Straker and Nina, we do see an exterior of the sub. There's a boom. The sub begins to float. Straker starts laughing maniacally, and then cut to Nina laughing out loud in the hospital bed, and then we get the, oh, happy ending. Oh, this is what you did? Yep, that's all there is to it. Nothing more to tell. And I'm kind of sitting back thinking, you know, in spite of whatever storytelling shortcomings or detail issues I might have spotted throughout this particular story, I was fully emotionally invested in the drama in terms of how the heck are you going to get these guys out?
I was
invested. And then all of a sudden, everything is safe. We're all good. And I felt horribly cheated. The part that – I guess what really bothers me is – I mean, we have a lot of dramatic tension, but the resolution – was nowhere near satisfying, and it sort of left me kind of feeling a little bit out of sorts. I mean, good stories need some kind of resolution or closure, and I didn't get any of that. In fact, all I was left with, as I said before, was happy ending, and then instead of the story coming to a natural close, emotionally, I felt the story just stopped.
And then they hit you with that awkward
with
well,
that very
Straker
very yeah
Nina thing and
yeah, the yeah. whole weird Straker thing, and then just as I'm emotionally trying to come to grips with what just happened, then I get slammed with the closing credits, which has got the eeriest music ever penned.
It is an interesting little piece as it goes.
So I think when you are telling any kind of story that you have, well, it doesn't, I guess, any kind of dramatic story. It doesn't matter if it's a love story. It doesn't matter if it's just pure drama. It doesn't matter if it's a thriller. It doesn't matter if it's a horror film. It doesn't matter if it's a disaster film. You need to, you're taking your viewer along for a ride, so to speak. and you have to deliver them safely to the end, just as you are delivering your protagonists to some kind of salvation from whatever disaster there is. The viewer and the characters in the story are on the ride at the same time, for lack of a better phrase. And for the writer to all of a sudden show us that our heroes have been saved just out of the blue, it's kind of like, you know, well, guess what? I'm still underwater. Thank you very much. You haven't brought me along with this.
But Nina's laughing in your face. That's exactly. That's the writer's joke.
She's laughing at my face because I'm still stuck in the frickin' sub.
You didn't have a sonic screwdriver. That's your problem.
Oh, I didn't have a magic wand.
No.
And I didn't wave at Aloha Mora and got myself out.
Yeah, I that ending. They took it all the way to the end, and we didn't.
They took it too far to the end.
That's right.
I mean, if we had given any kind of explanation, you know, I've got an idea. We can do this, and then just you only needed just a few minutes to see them come up with the idea and execute it, and then I would have experienced the payoff. And I would have had greater emotional satisfaction and enjoyed the laugh. You know, and instead of Nina laughing at me, I could be laughing with her, so to speak, as to how this whole thing played out. But we didn't get that. It made this out to be a very odd story. One that I think could have been incredible. It could have been great. But that ending just sucked any goodness out of it for me.
Yeah. I don't put it amongst the best. There are things I like, but it definitely is not one of my favorites. And there's not enough alien shooting in it.
No, we'll get more of that in the next show. And I mean the next show, Space 1999.
Yeah. Well, I haven't got anything else.
No, I've pretty much exhausted my points. Oh, just one.
Except for this one. Just one more.
Just one little bit of trivia. Does Skydiver only have four people on it?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to know.
Five
counting the captain?
Apparently. Nobody's working the engine room down there.
No.
Or if they are, they're all dead.
It's all automated.
You know, it's not. It's not a huge sub. If you look at the model, and you take a look at Sky One on the front, and you figure that the cockpit on that is the size of a human being, it actually isn't a very big sub. So,
it's the dimensions make it hard to tell.
Yeah, I. It's certainly not going to be one of those 78-men crewed subs. Five, considering that Foster and Straker are actually superfluous to the operation of the sub.
Oh, absolutely.
So, really, the crew is
You have the captain. You would have your navigator, helmsman, who was
sonar operator.
You have your first officer, who I guess that would be Lewis. And then your sonar expert, who in this case was Nina.
Yeah, so there's
four people.
Could be just a crew of four. Seems a little sparse. But they got computers.
Oh,
to help run things. Perhaps Sid can give them some help.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listeners, I hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
End of line.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. supposed to say Killstraker.
Killstraker!